Welcome, everyone, to Mention and Dispatches here with the Armchair Dragoons. We've got a full house tonight. We've got three distinguished guests joining us, and our topic tonight is going to be talking about teaching game design. We're looking at how folks actually sort of structure some game design curriculum for different purposes, because all of these guys approach it from different directions. And so from left to right on your podcast dial, Sebastian is back to join us for another round here. Last time he was here talking about the War Game Design Program at Georgetown University. So Sebastian is back to talk about the War Game Design Program at Georgetown University. How you doing, Sebastian?
Hey, thanks, Brian. It's really happy to be back here.
All right. Love it. Love it. Thank you. And our buddy Rex is back from north of the wall again. Rex has been using games in the classroom for a couple of decades, but actually teaching wargaming for the last couple. I say wargaming, probably peace gaming as well. Since
conflict access. Simulation,
but simulation.
We don't really care about the labels.
No. We're not gonna, you know, fight the 12th holy war of what is a war game. We're gonna skip that. Because we've killed entire podcasts on that. So, and then a new voice to our podcast here with the Armchair Dragoons, Mr. Jeff Tidbull, who I've gotten to know a little bit through Gamma, but is also the COO of Atlas Games and runs his own consulting firm. And so Jeff is teaching a game design course at, it's UW Stout, correct?
That's right.
I say at, but you're probably teaching it from your living room because of the pandemic and everything, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's the reason I got this opportunity when they needed to add another section, is because they were able to take remote teachers because so many of their classes are not on campus this semester.
Yeah. I saw a quote the other day online that I think was meant to be funny, but was really depressing the more you think about it, and said, "We're not working remotely. We're all living at work." And I think that was intended to be funny and just really kind of sad. Welcome, everyone, and we appreciate you being here. Just real quick, Jeff, we're going to start with you. The course you're teaching at UW Stout, sort of what level is it aimed at, and in terms of where in school the students are, and is this sort of a first step towards a larger program, or is this kind of a one-off sort of elective that they get to use with their other study?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. So I'm teaching GDD 100, which is the intro to game design course for that's broadly targeted at first year students who are entering a BFA program in game design. The students are a mix of computer science folks and like art and illustration folks, and they split there. I don't want to say that I know a great deal about the inner workings of their program because I haven't been at Stout for a particularly long time. And as a one course adjunct, I'm not really, you know, enmeshed in the gears and works of it. But most of the students are first year students. Some transfer students are a little bit further into their college careers than that. But for, I would say, the vast majority of them, this is their first academic experience with game design. They most of them come to this with a ton of experience playing lots and lots of games, so experiencing them as not consumers and as gamers. But I don't get the sense that they're coming with a lot of academic baggage in terms of what game design is, how it ought to be done, how games ought to be analyzed, how games ought to be criticized in an academic sense, and things like that. So that's. We're starting from zero as far as the coursework goes.
You sort of started to answer what was going to be one of my follow-up questions, which was the relative level of experience of people in the course. It sounds like novice game designers, but experienced gamers.
Yeah. You know, it's going back to the distance learning thing, it is a little bit more difficult to get a sense of exactly where each student is at when they are a list of 20 some odd names on a Collaborate Ultra screen. But you know, as we get further into the semester, you get more of a sense. And there are some students who have played a lot of stuff. We just got through some presentations that students did, and on existing games, and the number of hours that some of them have put in to some of their favorite games is staggering to me. Yeah, anyway.
I can imagine. Rex up there at McGill, I know you're teaching in the poli sci faculty, so it's not a game design program. It's built around the poli-sci faculty, the poli-sci course load, right?
Yeah. So Poli 452 is an upper level undergraduate elective in political science in conflict simulation. It's not necessarily a course in game design, although they do game design. It's a course in conflict simulation in which they're also looking at games as instructional or analytical or policy development tools. As most of them are political scientists, most of the rest are other social scientists studying other social science. I have one keen war gamer, maybe one or two. I'd say an average distribution of gamers for that age cohort.
And the folks that are in the course as you've got it in your program there, is this just one of a couple of different elective options towards that poli-sci degree?
Yeah, we are, yes, and we are a very big department. So, I mean, we've got, you know, whatever, I have no idea what our current number is, 850, 860 students in the program. So there are a lot of courses to choose from, and this just happens to be one of the upper level.
Was this something that you ended up inheriting from somebody else, or is this something you kind of created because you just love doing gaming?
No, one of my courses in particular, which is the peace building course, has a lot of gaming in it, including our sort of infamous 12-hour day, 7-day long Civil War simulation. And it just got to the point that I had a lot of students asking me if they could do one-off independent studies courses on Wargamer conflict simulation design. So I thought, okay, well, maybe we'll offer an actual course on it. And sure enough, it fills up each year.
Sebastian, you got wrangled in, if I recall correctly, from the podcast we recorded about Goose way back when. You got wrangled into teaching simply because you had to be a faculty member in order to be a club sponsor, right?
That's pretty much it. Yeah, the short story is.
So the students you have, though, I mean, I've sat in some of your class presentation. I mean, sat in, right? Virtually, I was watching some of the class presentations one time. You've got a couple of older students in there, but are these undergrads or are they grad students?
So most of them are grad students within the Center of Security Studies or the Security Studies program. I do have some undergrads, and that's a weird term because we have at Georgetown a special 5-year undergrad master's program. So technically, they are much younger and come from a different demographic than my normal graduate students, who often come from work experience, from the military, or from other universities. But these are our young 5-year SFS students. But yeah, I do have some undergrad students in my class.
Yeah, but when they get out of the program, they're leaving with a master's, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So some of the, I think one of the presentations I was watching, you had an actual, like, you had an active duty Marine in there, right?
Yes.
Okay. So you've got a mixture of wet behind the ears youngsters and a couple of people who've actually been in the real world.
Yeah. So I think it is one of the greatest strengths of this graduate program, and it brings out different perspectives and different flavors to their game design. And honestly, I think the diversity of experiences and thought is one of the key components to their game designs. And often the students will select a topic or historical case study that is relevant to their own day job. So I had employees at State Department choose a region and a conflict that is relevant to their real jobs. Similarly, active duty Marines or active duty Army officers will choose something that is of interest to their own jobs, whether they're artillery officers or intel officers. They choose something that resonates with them.
Yeah. And your class is completely, it's just a one-off. It's the intro to wargame design, and that is the only one of its kind in that program, right?
Yeah, for now. Hopefully more courses that build on it. This is something I want to do in the future, building on different formats and different types of gaming. Given the constraints of my course and time, my class is narrow in the sense it focuses on manual military war games, right? So yep. If I could do other classes, I would do a whole different class on analytical gaming or different types of gaming like naval warfare or Matrix style games, you know what I mean? There's so much more to scratch under the surface, but I just don't have enough time. So there is a certain constraint that you have to leave things on the cutting room floor when you're designing a curriculum.
something I'm just curious about, just the it's been a hot topic over the last year and a half in terms of the issue of diversity in gaming. And so, Sebastian, I know you've got some women in your course. Rex, you've always talked about yours is like a 50-50 split. Sebastian, what's the rough split of sort of that dreaded white male wargamer stereotype demographic in your course versus everybody else?
So overall, I would say probably 30%, 20% is roughly around where the gender ratio breaks down, about 30% okay. women, about 70% male.
Okay. And Rex, you're about a 50-50 split.
It varies from year to year. It's usually somewhere in the 40 to 50 range. I think it's closer to 40 this year, but it's a large chunk.
Yeah. Jeff, what's the rough gender split? Because again, Rex and Sebastian are mainly coming out of the wargaming world, which is sort of our core shtick here with the Dragoons, but that's not a world you're fully, you know, in, that you're a little adjacent to that.
Sure. Since this is only one semester that I've taught this, and it's not really possible to generalize it out across a couple of years, my guess is it is probably not entirely inside FERPA's the ability of what I should say about the specific students in this class.
No, I understand.
I don't think you would be surprised by the information.
Yeah. And we don't want to get anybody in trouble. And I know it's tough, you know, where you've got the one-off class versus, you know, having seen it over the course of a couple of semesters.
But so what I could talk about, I suppose, I did over a number of years a workshop at Gen Con where we invited people to come in. And so that was a 4-hour workshop for people who were interested in doing game design as a popular entertainment. So these are the people who are kickstarting games now or who are starting their own publishing companies. I did those for just 12 people at a time because we wanted them to be very hands-on as opposed to sitting in a 50-minute seminar or what have you. And I would say for all of those that I offered, probably a dozen of them over a couple different years, that out of 12, it would be 9 or 10 men and 2 or 3 women on balance.
We are not even remotely attempting to broach the subject of, you know, is this good or bad or what should we do about it? It was just a point of curiosity in terms of kind of class more than this.
Sure.
So Sebastian and Rex, I know you guys have some very sort of defined, not so much defined, but more directed purposes in some of the courses you've got. Jeff, I think yours is a little more towards just sort of general entertainment hobbyist kind of game design, not necessarily with a professional or analytical bent the way some of the stuff Sebastian and Rex are doing. As you're teaching these students, you know, sort of how to design a game and what's important about game design, what's, if there's one thing that you want these kids to remember for the rest of their potential game design careers, what's like the one most important thing you want them to take out of that class?
You know, that's a great question. And I would say that it is not so much a piece of information that I would like them to come away with, but more a sense of or an appreciation of the fact that game design is a creative process similar to other creative processes. And here are the steps of it, right? You need to come up with ideas and then evaluate those ideas, select good ones to work on. You have to then iterate those ideas. Oftentimes your creative efforts will be more fruitful with a group of minds than with a lone quote unquote genius. And so that's what I would really like them to take away, is kind of the visceral experience of having been through that process so that they know what it looks like and they will not, you know, be scared of it or be apprehensive about it or not know what a future coworker says when they talk about developing a game or when they talk about building a prototype or when they talk about sending it back to a creative brief.
Okay. It wasn't necessarily looking for sort of what's the one mechanical skill they should, you know, I think that's absolutely right in the wheelhouse of sort of what I was kind of wondering what you're leaving them with in terms of, you know, what matters about game design, because I think, you know, that lesson, that idea is one that's going to transcend whatever current trends or fads are in gaming at the moment. And I think, you know, with your history in the industry, obviously you've seen everything come and go at various points in time. So that's a good perspective, I think.
Good. Yeah. I mean, we'll see. We'll check in with them at the end of the term, I guess, and find out if they feel like that was valuable or if what really they would have preferred to have is a set of three mental models that they can use to analyze a game design, you know?
So Rex, Sebastian, I know your guys' purposes are a little different. Rex, you've got the conflict simulation course, but you've also got the peace building one that I'm assuming there's some overlap in the participation between those two. In terms of the conflict sim course, if there's one key takeaway you want them to hold on to for the rest of their careers as potential wargamers out there, what is that one thing you want them to
Well, I mean, the course is really, although they're doing game design in it, and I've been impressed how many still opted to do game design in groups this year, even though they're spread all over the planet, having to collaborate digitally and they can't actually meet. But, you know, they are doing game design, but really what I want to come out of the course is an appreciation of when is a game a useful tool and how might it be used, and equally, when is a game not a useful tool. So first of all is putting their objectives front and center. So, you know, what are you trying to, if you're running a serious game, so this is really a course about serious games, not hobby games. If you're running a serious game, why are you doing it and what are you trying to get out of the game? And secondarily, you know, that the game has to be a model. You know, whatever the conflict is, and I've got students working on Nagorno-Karabakh, I've got students working on green technology in the U.S. auto industry, which is also competitive. You've got to think, how does this thing actually work? And what do I have to translate into game models? And is my gameplay going to give me a reasonable representation of how that process works? Now, the games they produce are often very, very fun. One of them from a few years back is being published by Nuts Publishing later this year. Ultimately, they need to produce something that's actually pretty good social science, that it recreates the dynamics of the conflict that they're examining.
Yeah, which might in turn mean that it's not necessarily a viable commercial product, but that's not the intent of what you're trying to do with your students, correct?
That's right. It's great if the game is fun, and if the game is incredibly boring, that's probably problematic. But, you know, fundamentally, they're not trying to produce something that's going to sell on the commercial market. They're trying to produce something that offers some insight into the kind of research question, into the puzzle, into the conflict that they're looking at.
And again, you know, by design, that is going to be different than the kind of stuff that Jeff is teaching with his students, which shows the breadth of the options out there in the game design world. Sebastian, I know your students probably lean closer to where Rex's guys are than where Jeff's guys are, but I've seen some of the student presentations and you've got a couple of folks there that have some legitimately viable commercial products.
Yeah. So to address your first question, I would say the one thing I want them to walk away with from my course is to be able to be intellectual omnivores, in the sense of being able to consume lots of different designs and lots of different ideas and lots of different points of view, and be able to apply them judiciously in game design and be able to apply them in their own sort of life, right? The other thing when it comes to the games themselves, they do produce educational tabletop manual games on a historical case study. It is true that my course aligns a little bit more closer to Rex, but because one of the requirements is that they produce a full rule book and a full standalone game, a couple of the student groups have pursued commercial publication and some are still going through that process right now, which has been slowed by COVID. But one of the hopes for the class is that the class produces a whole repository going forward of educational games that can be recycled back into our program at the Security Studies program or be lent out and shared with other educational institutions, both in the civilian side and the military professional education side.
Yeah, I want to know when we can actually get our hands on Sawyer's game from last year, because for folks that might be interested in the kinds of output you get from Sebastian's course, we've had two different presentations from his students at our digital conventions. The convention we had this past January 2021, he had a couple of presenters talking about the Russian roulette game, which was the game on the Ukraine the current crisis going on in Ukraine. But Sawyer's group, was it two or three people in her group?
There were three.
Yeah, I keep calling it Sawyer's group. I don't mean to short, you know, to sell the other participants short. It's just she's the one that did the presentation for our digital convention last summer on the Three Kingdoms. The scenario was ancient China, kind of one of the initial unifications of China, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a perfect example of a really interesting dynamic of groups. So Sawyer was one of my special five-year students. Another five-year student was in that group. And I had an active duty, I believe he was a major at the time in the Army. So that was a fantastic blend. So Sawyer brought a certain strategic game design approach, and she elevated the game's aesthetic element to it, the graphic design element to it. The Army officer brought a certain operational and tactical perspective, right? And the third member brought a certain research knowledge that her specialty was in Asia. So you know, Chinese history was something very familiar to her. Even though it wasn't her specialty. So the combination of those like skill sets was really, it produced a fantastic game, honestly.
Yeah, yeah. And by the time Sawyer was done with the presentation at our convention, everybody was asking where they could buy it. And of course, we all had to tell them, sorry, it doesn't exist yet, which was a little unfortunate. Sebastian, you've already mentioned, you know, the output at the end of the course is a full working playable copy of the game. Rex, for your conflict simulation course, what is there a comparable output at the end of the class that they're expected to deliver?
Yeah, this is the same output. I mean, they're expected to produce a playable game prototype by the end of the course. It was a bit different this year because I was not sure, because I literally have students on multiple continents this year. Yeah. Because of remote teaching. So I gave them the option of writing a research paper instead of doing the group game project, but very few people have opted for the research paper. I think they're all bored, stuck at home or stuck in their apartments or what have you. So they're game groups. It's just they don't actually get to meet. They're having to do it all over Zoom and Google Slides. Yeah. Or Roll20 or whatever they're using.
So Jeff, at the end of your course, you know, you'd mentioned that you've got a mix of folks that may end up as computer game designers versus people that might do tabletop stuff. Is there an expected output at the end of the course of here is a finished game?
Yeah, absolutely there is. And in this particular course, the tradition is that is a tabletop game. The computer science students are not particularly advanced. And this course is offered in the fall as well as the spring. So it's possible that students will come in and will like just be starting in their computer science journey. So in order to teach principles of game design without having everyone get lost in how is it going to get coded, I assume that that's where this tradition evolved. So the final output of this class, the class projects that we'll actually get started on next week, will be the three things that they are able to use is 10 letter-sized pages worth of print-and-play materials of whatever they want. So that's got to include a rule book if they've got any custom cards or reference sheets. They've got to be able to print out 10 pages worth of stuff and cut it apart if they want. They're allowed to use the full contents of one copy of the white box. So that is an assortment of about 400 dice and wooden cubes and punchboard tokens that are sort of generic in character. It's a bunch of discs and things like that. And then they're allowed a standard deck of playing cards as well. So that could be really a broad selection of stuff. I can easily imagine social games coming out of that. I can imagine RPGs theoretically coming out of that. 10 pages, not a lot to get that done, obviously. Card games, dice games. There's really a lot that they could do with that set of things. Now, traditionally, it has been create a physical prototype rather than a print and play thing. But the print and play version comes about due to the kind of pandemic realities. All of these games are presented at the end of the term, essentially at a convention that they throw, Stout Game Expo or SGX. So that has moved online, and the print and play aspect is intended to allow people to essentially virtually attend that. So they have like local employers come through. They have all kinds of sort of regional artists and other people that would be associated with the School of Design come through. And in normal years, they would play these games. But and the nice thing about it being virtual is actually my understanding is that in the fall, like parents will come through to the website where all of these projects are hosted and get a chance to to really look at the projects that their students have been working on.
Let's all just agree that these are not normal times. You know, I mean, that you know, there's all sorts of allowances having to be made for the fact that, you know, there is a plague ravaging the land at the moment, and we are stuck at home having to make do the best we can. I will say, though, the stuck at home thing hasn't been entirely bad because of the virtual connectivity and all of this. I was actually able to sit in one of Sebastian's classes one night, which was kind of cool, because I don't know that I would have been able to make the drive up to Georgetown to come sit in the classroom presentations with those guys for that time you invited me to join the crowd. So I'm, on one hand, I'm kind of glad everybody was stuck on Zoom for that one. That was nice. Jeff, you mentioned the white box, and we had briefly mentioned it before the recording started. For the audience at home, what is the white box, and how does that fit into your curriculum there with the class?
Yeah, so I'm in a unique position with that product in that I am the person who produced it. I've had an interest in teaching game design for a long time, in part just because as an extremely young person who I wanted to be a game designer since I was 12, right after the first time I played D&D. I thought that was the very greatest thing ever, and wanted to make a career out of that. And a lot of people who were professionals in the hobby game space really helped me. They answered infinite questions and pointed me in the right direction. So I have always had an interest in sort of returning that expertise back into people who are coming up now. So apart from that, I've got a partner in a side business. Will Heinmarch and I have a publishing imprint called Game Playwright, and we do nonfiction books that are about stories and games and the work of making them. And I ran into a guy named Jeremy Holcomb at a Gamma Expo. Man, maybe this was 10 years ago now. Jeremy teaches game design at DigiPen in Seattle, and he was at this pitch event with like five different games that he had designed. But in addition to these games, he had this prototype for the white box. And what this was is he had put together this idea for essentially a game design workshop in a box. So it's a box that's got, like I said before, cubes and dice and chips and tokens and stuff like that. But in addition to all of those things that you can buy at a craft store, it's got a book of how to design games. So how do you come up with a good idea? How do you just calm down when you get concerned that people are going to steal your idea? How do you playtest your idea? Should you come up with a theme first or mechanics first? Once you've got a design, how should you sell it at a convention? Do you need to form a company? Do you want to find somebody else to publish it? How do you do Kickstarter? Chapters on all of this stuff. And so when I saw that there, it seemed to me like that was a very natural product to do with Game Playwright, this side gig of Will and I. Now, the problem was that Game Playwright's was an entirely sort of print-on-demand outfit. Its entire inventory at any given time took up about a bookshelf and a half in my office. So we did not have a warehouse or anything like that. And there's no way to produce this product, you know, 20 at a time. This needed a print run of 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000. Long story short, it took us a long time, but we finally partnered with Atlas Games and kickstarted this this white box project. And I'll be very honest, I thought there was a substantial chance that Kickstarter would just fail and that no one was fundamentally all that interested in game design. And so it would not even be possible to produce even an extremely minimal run of this thing. Naturally, as is often the case, I was wildly wrong about this. And the Kickstarter blew up and did 10 or 12 or 15 times our funding goal. And had, I think, about 3,000 backers, maybe. Wow. We got a sponsorship out of Carta Mundi, who became very excited about training up new game designers. They're a card printer. And so this partnership with Atlas Games wound up putting a bunch of these copies of the white box out into the world. So after we fulfilled the Kickstarter, it's been a very strong seller for Atlas. It's been back to reprint now. I think its third reprint has just come out in the fourth quarter of last year. And so somewhere along the line there, Jay Little, who teaches the other sections of GDD 100 at Stout, decided that this ought to be sort of one of the foundational textbooks, essentially, of this class. The other ones he uses are characteristics of games. and theory of fun for game design. But it's good for, here's the reason I really like the concept behind the white box, is you can read a book of information about game design, but it is less actionable than you would want. But if you're holding a box full of the nonsense and ephemera of game design, it is very difficult to not become inspired to just start moving them around and putting them on the table and thinking about them in a way that is much more concrete than if you are leaning back in your couch reading a book. So anyway, that's yeah. what it is, and sort of, I guess, the long-winded story of how it came to be.
I a couple of years ago, I did a one-week summer camp at a local game store here in town, built around tabletop gaming. And basically we had a theme each morning, and in the afternoon they just got to play either whatever they brought in for each other, or pull, you know, check stuff out of the store's library there to play with, because the store's got a pretty robust library of 200-250 games to work from. On Thursday, I stopped on the way in and I hit the dollar store and I bought probably what looks like a bastardized version of your white box. I picked up a couple of decks of cards and a couple of packs of chess and checkers and a big thing of the clear glass marbles that for Craft Isle, and a couple other things, a couple of packs of dice. I probably spent a total of $20 just cleaning out a bunch of random bits and pieces from the dollar store and sort of dumped them all on the table in front of them, paired them all off and said, all right, design a game. This afternoon, we're going to play each other's games, see what you come up with. And these were 10 to 14 year olds. What was great about it was no preconceptions at all, no idea of what they should or shouldn't be doing. They just wanted to do stuff that kind of seemed fun. But it was completely just me kind of grabbing random crap off the shelf at the dollar store and not nearly as organized or thought out as that white box probably is.
Yeah, you know, Jeremy did a fair bit of thinking about what should go in and what shouldn't be in. It's funny because we actually did a lot of cutting down his initial proposed component list, in part because we wanted the box to have a retail price that made it a no-brainer to buy it if you were at all interested in game design. But in part because we had observed that, for example, there was a lot of, Jeremy had originally proposed putting blank playing cards into there. And even throughout the Kickstarter campaign, we would get lots of people asking us, you know, why aren't there playing cards in this? Games have cards in them. We got to be able to make up cards. But from our own experience prototyping games, man, cards are just a dime a dozen or a penny a million or whatever. Really, the best way to do that is to get an infinite stack of index cards and scribble on them very quickly and be completely prepared to just throw them away as you, you know, as you iterate a design. And so playing cards, we didn't feel like added to the value of the thing any more than a pack of index cards would. So we would much rather have somebody spend 85 cents on 100 index cards that they can get at any office supply store in the world instead of, you know, buying them from us, because we'd have to mark them up, right? We can't make index cards at the economies of scale that actual producers of them can. So it was interesting how much we iterated that set of components, I guess.
In terms of the journey that you take your students on from, hey, here's what we want you to learn in this class, here's the foundation we're going to lay so that you've got a basic understanding of what we're going to build off of. Rex, what's one of the first things that you lay down in front of them as kind of the foundation in that conflict simulation class that you kind of want to ground them in as you start to build the rest of the lessons on?
Well, this is going to come as no surprise to you, but I'll tell the story of the Western Approaches Tactical Unit, which is, you know, a great story. It's arguably one of the most consequential applications of wargaming ever. It's immediately understandable how it works. It worked because it was embedded in a broader institutional context. It wasn't just the games, but all sorts of intelligence and qualitative and quantitative analysis and so forth. And of course, the wargamers of the Western Approaches Tactical Unit were predominantly women and disabled men. So it's a great diversity story too. So
before you get too far into the story though, Rex, for the audience that may not, it's not just a wargaming audience that knows what Watchu is.
Don't get me started on Watchu too much. Western
Approaches. I know you can do an entire podcast on Watchu. I got it. Try to keep it to three sentences.
The Western Approaches Tactical Unit was a Royal Navy unit that wargamed out convoy protection, so anti-submarine warfare. It did so, it trained tens of thousands of Allied naval officers, but it also developed anti-submarine warfare tactics and doctrine for the Royal Navy and for Commonwealth navies. We copied it in Canada, the Indians copied it, the Australians copied it to some extent, and so on and so forth. And it used wargaming. I mean, it used a lot of other things, but it predominantly used wargaming. And a lot of young women Wrens, so female naval volunteers who had no anti-submarine warfare experience and no wargaming experience, but were very smart. And it is indeed ironic that the foremost anti-submarine tacticians of World War II were British young women as young as 17. So it's just a terrific story. It may end up actually being a Hollywood movie since the movie rights have now been sold. There's a full-length book about it. There's a lot of stuff online. The museum in Liverpool where the headquarters was established is going to do an entire display on wargaming. But it is a great story, and it captures students' interest very quickly. They can see how the game served a purpose, both training, educational, and analytical. And then we start to unpack from there, talk about the history of wargaming, talk about different types of wargaming. I mean, I use Phil Sabin Simulating War as one of the main course texts, but then start expanding it beyond wargaming to other applications of serious gaming. The key thing is to also get them playing games, because most of them do not have a background in conflict simulation. So that has, you know, always a challenge. I run an awful lot of games. They have to come to a certain number of games over the term, and just getting them to play stuff and talk through why was this design decision made? Why has the designer done this? What's the effect of this set of rules? Looking at common game mechanisms and so on and so forth is really, really important.
Yeah. Yeah. I think probably what's one of the coolest things about WATU is that there's it's not just, hey, here's a practical application of a game design, but it's one that's sort of very real to a lot of them. You know, World War II is not that long ago that people don't remember what was going on there. So
it also has a lot of eureka moments where you can point to how the game combined with other information led to key insights into anti-submarine tactics. So it's quite easy to show the cause and effect of the value of the serious game.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Sebastian, Game of Thrones Risk, right? Isn't that the foundation of your entire class?
Yeah, pretty much. You nailed it on the head.
What's the foundation, the sort of that underlying starting point for your students there?
So you joke, but that's probably the game I introduced to them to the most. Another game that I often use is Frederick by Rio Grande Games, which is a German game that's published in the States. Other times, also one of the things that I'm increasingly using are games that were designed specifically for education by the military. For example, like McWill's and Wargaming Division's Assassin's Mace, which was designed by Colonel Barrett at the Wargaming Division at Quantico. That's a game that I had them consider because it was a game designed for the military for training and educational purposes. And that's sort of exactly what I want them to consider as they're doing design. The students don't design analytical games. They design games that are designed for education and training, either in the civilian classroom or for a military audience.
Rex, I'm astounded he doesn't have Aftershock front-loaded in his class. Like, what's
that? So I have Aftershock, and I played it. I got it actually at Connections North last year. When we were allowed to be in person. But one of the reasons I don't use Aftershock in my game per se is because, again, because of the program I sit in, we have a very heavy military case study. So my students are given a pre-approved list, and it's 3 pages long, so it's not a short list, but it spans all the way from antiquity to present day. But most of them are military case studies. For instance, you have the Punic Wars, you know what I mean? Italian words of unification, all these sort of things, but they all, because of the concentration that my class fulfills in the program, it focuses almost predominantly on military operations.
Yeah. For context for Jeff and anyone in the audience that doesn't know, Rex was the primary designer of Aftershock, the sort of serious game for emergency and disaster relief training. And it grew out of a workshop at Connections 2011, 2012.
Somewhere around there, yep.
Yeah, it was a while ago, but it grew out of that and became a thing that lots of folks actually use in the serious games world these days. So for folks in the audience that didn't catch the reference of where Aftershock was, that's That's why we brought that one up, because that is one of Rex's things. Jeff, I imagine at some point, do you address the idea of games' value outside of just having fun playing games, and at all even cross over into discussing the serious gaming world or the analytical gaming world that Rex and Sebastian inhabit? Or is that beyond sort of where you're structuring your course?
That is mostly beyond where we're structuring this course. Most serious things that we have discussed are not inside the games per se, but the serious nature of the creative challenges of creating games. So, for example, we recently listened to, there's an episode of the Anthropocene Reviewed about the origins of Monopoly and how it was not so much Charles Darrow's light bulb moment that brought Monopoly into the world, but rather Charles Darrow's sort of collecting of a game that was fundamentally crowdsourced based on an earlier design much, much in advance of that. And whether that represents creative justice or whether this guy lucked into a ton of money, what is the nature of creation, I guess? Can you ever look at a group project and say that one mastermind is behind it all? So, like, I think those are serious subjects, but that's not what we really mean when we talk about serious games, I don't think.
No, that's a serious topic in terms of the game business, but not necessarily, I think, the more serious applications of the games, which, again, is a little different world for where Sebastian and Rex live than I think what a lot of students first entering school or thinking, oh man, I'd love to be a game designer because they're seeing cool games on the shelves at the store. And you know, I want to do that because that's cool.
Yeah, that's right.
This may be something that's sort of beyond some of the different courses, but I know it's a really important thing for people studying design to take with them. At some point, and Jeff, you started to touch on this a little bit. At some point, you've got this great idea, and I've got this wonderful game, and I've tested it with a bunch of folks, and everybody agrees it's fun. And so now what? Do you spend much time at all on sort of what happens after the game is designed? So in your case, it's more sort of the commercial prospects of it. Rex, Sebastian, I know you guys have a slightly different viewpoint because those designs are often being done at the behest of a sponsor who's asked thing. But Jeff, focusing on that commercial aspect for your guys, how much, if at all, time do you intend to spend on now what? Once the game,
you know, I lost about half of your question there when the internet glitched out. I'm going to attempt to answer it. and if I get the question wrong, you let me know.
No problem.
So there is not a great deal. We're not trying to take the games that are designed in this class and push them out to really do anything more than to serve as an exercise. Mm-hmm. I think it is likely that I will point the students to a couple of contests whose deadlines are actually coming up in the summer and suggest to them that that would be a fine next step for something to do with a game that they have designed. The Game Crafter, for example, is always and forever running contests to promote their services. And there are more and more contests. So that's something I think concrete that could come out of designs in this class, or designs that are put together for this class.
Well, so in terms of the curriculum overall, not necessarily what they're going to do with this specific design for the class, but how much, if at all, do you spend any time on within the game process itself? Okay, great. I've got an awesome game design that's now a complete finished product. What happens next? And kind of that business side of things at all. Is that beyond the scope of what you're doing with your course? Because I would think that given your industry background and track record over the last several decades, that would be a really key thing that you would have to put in front of those students.
Oh, sure. So it is an explicit part of the 6 syllabus points that I'm supposed to cover in this class to talk about the internal creative process that goes on while designing a game. So like how do the development stages get handed off between different professionals that are involved in that? So we'll do a week on Gantt charts and the associated nonsense. If we have time, we'll talk about like budgeting And as part of budgeting, we'll probably talk about making realistic sales guesses. I've got, I put together once on my blog a budget template that tabletop game designers can use. So this is floating around out there. If folks go to my website, it's very easy to find there, but there's a Google sheet that you can just clone a copy of and start plugging in numbers and figure out how to make your game profitable for release. So if we have time, we'll get into that. I'm not super optimistic given how long stuff has taken to date. I'm always trying to cram 800 pounds into a 500 pound sack in every one of these 2-hour classes that we've got. And obviously the most important thing is to get them through the process of making these games. But if we have time, I do think that is an extremely valuable set of things to understand as a person who wants to design games. How are they going to be released? What do you need to do to make them attractive to buy, and all kinds of things like that? That's fundamentally a part of the game business that I am better at than blunt force design, for better or worse.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you are in a, you know, you've earned all of that experience that you are carrying with you in the actual business of the gaming world, that gives you a much bigger perspective on that than, you know, most other folks that might just sort of stagger in and go, yeah, I can teach how to design a game. I wasn't sure how much you were able to bake that into class there. You know,
yeah, we'll see. And the thing that is, I guess, sad for these students, many of whom want to design digital games, is I don't know the first thing about how to tell them to structure distribution of a mobile game or a PC game or a console game, right? That's a completely different area of expertise.
Yeah. So, Rex, I'm figuring you probably don't put Stephen Downs Martin's Three Witches speech in front of your students, although it wouldn't surprise me if you did. But going out of your con sim class, sort of what do you do next? How much time do you spend on that?
Yeah, his piece is actually listed in the recommended but not required readings, but it gets covered. We have a lecture on wargaming pathologies, on what goes wrong in war games, and so the Three Witches absolutely gets covered in my lecture with a recommendation they go read it. I'm interested that by the end of the course in their future careers, and they're political scientists, they're going to go on, many of them, and work in foreign service, in, you know, national security establishment, in other government departments, in journalism, in aid, in humanitarian stuff, all places where I've used serious games. I want them to be able to recognize when a game might be a useful way of addressing an issue, an awareness issue, an educational issue, an analytical or policy development issue. So I do get into some of the institutional setting issues. I get into some of the process issues. I get into why a game might be a useful tool and when, and also how a game goes off the rails. And when you may want something that's less than a game. So I talked them through, because I was involved in designing it, the Canadian government's vaccine rollout exercise, and talked about all the decisions that it went into it that were related to bureaucratic process and political sensitivities and limitations of technology and where it had to fit in the schedule of rolling out the COVID-19 vaccine. Because I want them to think of that broader process, not just the game and that's it.
Yeah. Sebastian, I know a handful of your students end up out in the think tank world. Look, you could make a game out of the government contracting process and probably drive a lot of people nuts with sort of sad, rueful laughter in the whole thing. How much, if at all, do you dress kind of that now what question, right? You got the great game on the table. Now what do I do with it?
So ideally, I would like them to submit their games at the end of the class, either to be used in the curriculum or to a publisher. So I make sure to connect them to people who can use their game. So either that's at a PME school or a civilian curriculum that I think their game is well suited for. Other times it's about connecting them to publishers or people who may be interested in collaborating or adding to their game. But a lot of times I encourage them to build games from the get-go in which they can use. So if they're active duty commanders in the force, I ask them, hey, you should probably consider building a game for your unit, for your MOS, for your profession. If you work at State Department, maybe build a game for your coworkers than one that can be used to inform your expertise or your training or education within your bureau, right? So that's why I really encourage them to do. A lot of the games right now are trying to find homes in various ways and in various stages. Some are in publication queues, waiting for reviews with publishers. Others have been sent out to PME schools that have been looking for games for particular classes or historical periods. And we also are increasingly taking case study requests from other schoolhouses and units who are asking us, hey, I need a game on XYZ conflict, looking at this kind of angle. And we like to encourage those because I think it's very useful for games to have a useful home at the end.
Mm-hmm. For the audience that may not know some of the acronyms out there, PMEs, the professional military education. So that's the different career schools that the military sends folks through, both officers and enlisted, as they develop and grow in their careers in the military throughout their extended time. Jeff, on the way out the door for some of your students, once they finish this, you know, you mentioned that a bunch of these students are intending to go on to a formal curriculum that is a game design degree at the end of it all. As these folks are sort of preparing for that career, I mean, it almost seems like you get them first, right? I mean, they come through your class on their way to whatever comes next. What are some of those skills that you, not necessarily things you're developing in the class, but the kinds of things you encourage them to put into their toolbox beyond just the game design as they move on into that career, if that's, you know, your place to do that at all in that program there?
Sure. We are working a lot on just kind of an easy and second nature facility with being able to pitch ideas. And specifically, we're working on just pitching game ideas. So even to a very formulaic extent, we spend a ton of time working on X is a game about Y. X is a game where players try to Y by Z. That is, it's a title and an objective and a what do players try to do to meet that objective. Because once you've got that basic format, you can brainstorm many, many different kinds of games that will not accidentally not be games, you know, once you have started inventing ideas about them. That was the very most useful thing I learned at film school. The first time I left gaming forever, I went to film school and got a screenwriting degree. And the skill from film school that I use every day is an ability to pitch creative ideas to other people, whether I want them to help me build it or help me improve an idea. But just for any creative profession, I think it is extremely important to be able to talk with ease about your ideas and describe them to other people so that they can, you know, buy them or help you with them or whatever. So we're working a lot on that. In the second half of the course will be more about refinement, I think, but it will serve these students really well in their second and third and fourth years of coursework, especially as they work in groups to make games, which is something that happens a lot inside this particular program, to be able to describe ideas to each other in a way that is useful. So we're working a ton on that.
You kind of hit on it a little bit with the film school reference there, but if there's a course, particularly sort of a skill-focused course that is not a part of the required game design curriculum that you think would be a good idea for these kinds of students to take as a part of that career, you know, again, looking back at sort of your experience in the industry, what's something that you would steer these students to say, hey, this is going to be an elective, but I think it's an important elective where you will learn valuable skills to help you in the industry as you go forward?
I would send people to do some kind of a writing course that is not creative writing and is also not like essay analytical writing, but that is, I don't know that this course exists in anyone's curriculum, but I think that writing is so crucial to thinking, and the ability to express your ideas in writing is so crucial to getting people on board with your ideas. And it's a skill, and it's a hard skill, and people are not emerging from high school or even emerging from their undergraduate degrees necessarily with just a crack professional level of writing with accuracy and brevity and clarity, and presenting it with style will enable them to really succeed in their careers. I would send them off to do more writing in almost any kind of a coursework.
Having taught a whole bunch of freshman and sophomore level writing classes, as well as some development / remedial writing classes at the university level over the last decade and change, they are not coming out of high school able to write squat. It is painful to see some of the things that passes for writing for some of these students that I've had over the years. So,
although I've got to say, some of them are coming out with that. There's a really wide variety. So I don't know. I just want to give some of them credit, because there are some really good writers in my class, but not uniformly so. Let's
see. And I think if you probably dug into it, you would find that the ones that are pretty good writers are probably the same ones who frequently read lots of books that aren't actually assigned to them, the ones that spend some time doing some writing because they enjoy writing, not because it's forced upon them. That the ones that are already intellectually curious enough towards that are the ones that have developed that skill just through the dumb luck of repetition, not necessarily through any sort of formalized process.
That seems likely. I would love to know. I mean, I assume that all of educational America would love to have an extremely organized idea of how to make better writers.
Yeah. The same thing I would teach all of my writing students is like every other skill, right? The way you get better at it is you do it. And too often these folks, the extent of their writing is text messaging each other.
I mean, we had to have a very explicit discussion at one point that sentences start with capital letters and end with sentence ending punctuation. And I don't care what you're like, I honestly do not care what their text messages look like. And I want to like not be the wild-eyed hand waving old guy who doesn't believe that the format of writing shouldn't adapt to its medium. So Facebook message is going to look different from critical reviews in an academic setting. But for anything they turn into me, that the sentences, they just got to start with capital letters, and they got to end periods or exclamation points or question marks or something that has a legitimate business ending a sentence.
Rex, again, you've mentioned the wide variety of places that your students go when they're leaving your program that do not involve designing games for commercial purposes, which is where Jeff's students are likely to end up. But if there's something beyond that kind of game design world that you want them to take as a skill away, as might relate back to that game designing, you've mentioned over the years that being an analyst who games is probably more useful than being a wargamer who learns the analysis after the fact. Am I summing up your thoughts correctly there?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm teaching conflict simulation as a tool. It could be an educational tool. It could be an analytical or policy development tool. It could be a crowdsourcing tool. I mean, it's a number of things you can use it for. But I'm very much teaching it as a tool that should be sitting in their toolbox, and they should know how it works, what it does well, what it doesn't do very well, what mistakes people make using it, when they might want to use it, what their considerations would be when using it. And so, you know, some of the things we talk about are not, you know, game mechanisms. They're how long do you have your participants for? Who are they? When is lunch? You know, when you're running serious games, those things can be super, super important. So I want them to treat it as another tool in a sort of policy analysis or education.
So you're going to spend at least some time, not just on here's how to design a game and here's what makes a game work and here are good and bad characteristics, but also whether or not a game is even appropriate. And if it's not, what are the other tools available?
And the compromises you have to make, because you know, you've got to run the game in an afternoon.
Yeah.
You know, so sometimes you've got a game, but it's got to run in 2.5 hours because that's all the time you're going to get the senior leader for. Or in the case of the COVID-19 exercise, you're suddenly going to have 150 people show up from coast to coast to coast, and it can't be too gamey or you will lose them all because you're trying to do it all over WebEx. So, you know, there's some really practical considerations that go into serious game design as well.
Yeah.
Rex, and I am I want to ask a question, Russ. I'm super fascinated by that thing you threw out about when lunch is, because that made me wonder if anybody has attempted to design a long form game that puts off lunch in kind of a secret way in order to agitate all the players and try to tempt them into making bad decisions.
I have kind of done that because I have a refugee game, which is a full day game. It's like a 6-7 hour game. I've run it both at McGill and I've run the University of Exeter in the UK, in which the refugees don't actually get to eat unless they've earned enough in-game cash to purchase food. Whereas the policymakers all get catered lunch.
I love that.
Yeah, the nice thing about students, Sebastian and you will probably both agree, is they will do all kinds of things that you can't otherwise do. I mean, they're game for anything. So if you say, you know, we're going to run a 7-hour game on the weekend, but some of you won't get to eat unless you do well, they're up for it. I can't ever do that to, you know, diplomat.
I mean, you could, but
no, I can't. They'd never have me back again.
That's the point. You could, but only once. Sebastian, again, like you've got a one shot fire and forget kind of course. As students are leaving your course, if you've got the ability to say, hey, in addition to all this game design stuff, you really ought to go check out that course over there that will help make you a better game designer. What's something that you would point
to? So one of the reasons I started the Georgetown University Wargaming Society was because I wanted something to point to for them to continue their development as war game designer. And I'm a firm believer if you really do want to be a war game designer, one of the things you have to do is keep designing games and be exposed to the literature, to the people, to how wargaming is being used in our field at the time, how it's going to be used in the future. And that's one of the reasons we wanted to use Goose as sort of like both as a way to funnel people into the course, but also to catch people on the way out. So often I use my course as a crucible to see who survives and who does well and sort of sneak them into the executive committee for the Georgetown Wargaming Society. And hopefully they will have more chances to run games, to interact with our speakers that we run weekly, to have more opportunities to design games. I lead a lot of pet projects after for Goose, where I sort of put together a pickup team of student designers, and I'll find a sponsor for us to say, hey, I have a bunch of young designers who want to design you a game. What things do you need designed for you, right? Or sometimes they come to us. So that's sort of what I try to do. In terms of the curriculum at Georgetown and what classes I have them go to, is usually I tell them to keep doing in classes in which they feel like they want to keep wargaming in, right? So if you're really interested in China, Asia, or, you know what I mean, air power, right? Like keep going at that. But also at the same time, I tell them to go and one, do their thesis class, because I think writing is very important. What Jeff said is like writing a long form paper or writing well is, and being able to communicate concisely and effectively in the written word is a law skill, I think. A second thing is that I tell them to go and do a technical or graphic designs course, right? University is one of those great places where you can expand your horizons with electives, unlike any other period in your time. So I tell them that, hey, go take the classes that the library gives you on Illustrator or Adobe. Go to the Makers Lab that we have on campus and learn how to make 3D printed objects, right? I tell them to go expand their horizons as much as possible before they graduate.
Jeff, you alluded to this earlier, but I want to come back, and this is more focused towards you, because some of the stuff Rex and Sebastian are teaching, their students are sort of set up for very specific directed purposes. But Sebastian mentioned the idea of sort of iterating on things and like keep designing games. With the idea of the film school pitch thing really sort of struck a chord with me, in that like many other game designers, you probably have a closet full of ideas that are anywhere from 10 to 40% complete to actually being a real game design. I don't know of any game designer that doesn't have a backlog of things that seemed like a good idea and you got started on it and it sort of died on the vine. Often for very good reasons, right? Often it wasn't as good an idea as you thought it was when you started, once you started developing it out. But when you've got the students in front of you and you're sort of throwing out all of these kinds of ideas. Is it something that you discuss in the class at all, the idea of let's just throw out all kinds of good ideas and see what sticks? Is it, do you spend any time or much time at all sort of how do you deal with not getting discouraged looking at the backlog of bad ideas that didn't develop anywhere? Take us through a little bit of sort of how you approach that, either in the course or honestly in your professional life as well a little bit.
Yeah, sure. We're actually in the process in class right now of what amounts to a gigantic idea bake-off for the ideas that groups will actually develop for the final projects in the course. I think this was perhaps shocking to some of the students when I first did it, but we just in class, I told them to open up a document and that they had 10 minutes to come up with 10 ideas for games according to this X is a game where players try to Y by Z. And they really struggled with that the first time. But by the second and third times we had done that, they were finding it a lot easier to do it. So it you know, really is kind of a practice leads to a better ability to brainstorm. And we talked about specific strategies for brainstorming as part of that. So across 22 students, we have now each one of them developed 30 different ideas for games that are formal games in some sense. So that's however many it is, 700 some odd game ideas. Each one of them had to winnow their list of 30 down to 5 and do a 4-minute presentation on those 5 ideas to the rest of the class, received feedback from every one of their classmates on the rank order of those ideas that each other student, right? So if you presented ideas A, B, C, D, and E, then the other 3 of us in this pod of 5 would say, well, I like C best and D second best and so on. So then you will, taking into account that feedback from your peers on which of your ideas are interesting to them, sort of mix that in with your own evolving ideas about which one of those 5 ideas is any good. And then tomorrow morning at 12:20, we will start in on the finalist round of presentations where each student is going to pitch their one favorite idea to the rest of their class. And then everybody is going to rank from amongst the 22 students which of the of those 22 ideas are the top 10 that they would like to work on in a team of somewhere between 4 and 6 for the next 7 weeks to do the final class. So we are literally doing that thing. We're starting with 700 ideas and winnowing them down to about 5 that will actually be worked on and developed. So they're becoming familiar with how are we going to judge these ideas? Like, do they have a compelling theme that makes me laugh? Is that what's going to make me vote it up? Do I think that that is a clever game mechanic that's been pitched to me as part of this? Do I think that one of these ideas is just really hysterical and I would love to work on it, but I understand also that there is no way that this idea can be reduced to a 10-page print and play that we can actually make? Is it necessary for us to produce 1,000 pages of content in order to realize this idea? So I guess that's a really long-winded way of saying that we are absolutely engaging with that at this exact time, the idea of coming up with lots of ideas, figuring out how to winnow them down, figuring out how to present them back to the class and using that to get to the point of something that they'll actually make.
It may not be an explicit lesson within the class. It may just be something that they kind of absorb through going through that process. But yeah, you know, how is it that you look at the, you know, we started with 700 ideas to get to 2 good ones, like the other 698. You look at that mountain of ideas that didn't go anywhere and you think, God, I suck at this. 698 to 2 is a lousy ratio. But like the 2 is what you want to end up with in terms of good ideas. Is that just the norm? I mean, how do you keep people from going full lemming at that point?
The thing that I have said out loud, hopefully frequently enough that it will actually sink in, is that the goal of all this brainstorming is not to prove that most of our ideas are terrible, but it is more to prove that the first or second or third ideas that we come up with are often derivative and boring, and that in order to get to ideas that are really unique and interesting and push the envelope, the only way to get to those ideas is to just write down all of the ones that are derivative and boring, and then instead of going to make a sandwich when it gets hard, continuing to brainstorm more ideas. That's been my own experience of where interesting ideas come from, is when, like, almost like the process of running a mile race or a marathon or something, is that you discover where your endurance lies only after you have done the easy part of it and kind of discard it. And it's not like those ideas are terrible. They are, the ideas are derivative because somebody else has made successful games like that. So, like, it's not interesting to create another World of Warcraft, but that doesn't mean that World of Warcraft is terrible. It just means that World of Warcraft already exists and everybody is familiar with it, and you can't be a non-Blizzard creator of World of Warcraft today and make any money, because Blizzard has already made it.
Sebastian, Rex, I know that part of what your students are expecting when they get out there in the real world is that it's a lot less blue sky. It's a lot less, hey, I got a great idea, and a lot more, hey, I've got a specific topic that I need to try to tackle. And Rex, like you said, the game may be the appropriate tool in the toolkit. Or Sebastian, as you've seen in Think Tank Land with your students out there, that they're calling you up and going, hey, I've been told I have to put together a game on X. You know, that's because that's the job. That's what they signed up for. And so when you're preparing them for those more directed assignments that they get handed to them that are, you know, a world apart from where Jeff's students are, what are some of those kinds of almost the psychological approach to tackling that? Sebastian, how do you kind of focus, help the students focus on those things?
So for me, I spend 2 weeks, probably similar to Rex, about the pathologies of wargaming, how war games can go wrong, both in design and in execution. I spend another whole week on sort of how to deal with sponsors and analytical wargaming and the challenges that presents. For me, I tell my students to focus that if they are full-time wargame designers in the DoD, which there are not many of us, is that your job is to be a functional expert. Your job is to convert, right, someone's vision, someone's research, often into a game, right? So it's very similar to how like a creative director would implement someone's vision, right? Or their own vision sometimes. So, you know what I mean? I don't always have to be an expert in China or anti-submarine warfare or air combat or a particular problem set, like let's say cyber, right? But my job is to convert someone else's expertise and my own research sometimes into a game design that fits their objectives, right? Your job is to get their, you know what I mean, questions to the right place where you can ask the right kind of decisions and explore a particular dynamic, right? So that's why I tell them. Also, sometimes I tell them that you have to do the groundwork of game design to go through the process of learning from the very bottom, right? So, you know, sponsors can be difficult. You know what I mean? Sometimes you don't always design the game you want, right? Because that's the game you want to design is not the game they need. But that's just something you have to get over with, you know what I mean, and understand that you're a professional in this field and you have to do what you're asked to do.
Yeah, I think part of that, so we mentioned earlier Stephen Downs Martin's Three Witches paper / presentation, because he's done it as a speech a few times as well. It's linked to this podcast. You can go hit the link and go see what's there. But that's definitely a part of living with those sponsors out there that happens in the professional world. Rex, much to add to kind of the perspective that Sebastian had there?
No, and you know, I don't really get as much time as I would like in a 13-week course to do that. And I will say overall, I think political science programs are very poor at giving students a sense of bureaucratic process. My other course, one of my other courses, my peacebuilding course, it has this immense, incredibly long, complex, week-long Civil War simulation precisely to help students understand how the challenges of bureaucratic process, of organizational politics, of coalition building, of coming to agreements, of coordination and so forth. And I will say, as a political scientist, I think that most students will come out of political science degrees in general not having a very good sense of what it actually looks like from inside government, how the sausages of policy get made.
Yeah, the limited experience that I have in that world, I'm just not sure how you would do that. So, you know, not, you know.
Well, that's what games are great for. You put them in a really complex game in which they have good ideas and they can't move them forward unless they know how to build coalitions and work out where others are coming from and push the right organizational buttons and so forth.
I have one more sort of question around the table here before I've got some business we've got to attend to here on the podcast. But I am really curious, and Jeff, you had mentioned this earlier. I think I know part of the answer for you. When you sat down, you know, hey, congrats, you're going to be teaching this course. You've got to build the syllabus. And I think you had mentioned earlier, like there's some things that are sort of directed as a part of the curriculum there and the program that you're in. But when you sit down to build that syllabus, you know, it's what's the first thing you're looking at, and what was the first thing you were looking at and went, man, I got that. And what's the first thing you were looking at and went, holy crap, that, and it just sort of kind of scared the hell out of you.
Honestly, the thing that became most fearful as I got into it is how much time it was going to take me to build that syllabus before classes even got off the ground. So yeah, you know, the thing that has been most surprising to me is how much time it takes to teach students. This really is and this is not really even a fair answer to your question, because you're really asking about content, but the most surprising thing to me has been how much time you can spend if you really want to do it well. Man, is that even a useful thing to talk about, Brant?
This is, again, the podcast is the podcast. It's sort of, we're all over the place. Honestly, given the track record of our podcast over the years, I'm surprised we've managed to stay this well on topic for almost 90 minutes. So that's kind of cool. You know,
you know, the thing that it is most like, honestly, is doing game master duties in a role-playing game, because you've kind of got to tap dance at just the right level of interesting and informative and dramatically compelling to keep students interested. So like running tons of D&D and other RPGs for 20 some odd years is maybe the most useful training to teaching that I have got in my background.
You're not the first person to note that, I don't think, over the years. Rex, I think you explicitly called that out on Twitter one time, didn't you?
There's a whole Pax Sims piece on D&D as professional development. It's probably the most useful preparation for game facilitation when you're running a serious game is having spent time as a DM.
Yeah. Yeah. Sebastian, you literally built the syllabus from scratch for what you've got, because I remember being CC'd on some of the traffic for, hey, building a new syllabus. Anybody got any good ideas? What, when you first sat down to do this, like how much of it was, hey, I know exactly what I want to do here, and how much of it was, holy crap, what do I do next?
I think the whole thing was, I don't know what to do. I was asked by Georgetown to put the syllabus together, and I said yes, because I wanted to teach this class. I wanted somebody to be teaching this class in the program. But at the same time, it was my first time putting a syllabus together. So I've done what I always do in game design, is when I don't know what to do, I ask someone smarter than me. So I emailed a bunch of people I respected and admired in the field. And I asked them, hey, how did you put your course together? How do you design your class? And I, like a good designer, I emulated and imitated and, you know, threw my own twist into it. I borrowed from other people's syllabuses. I thought about the readings that shaped my thinking as a game designer. And every year, as I'm, you know, I mean, still pretty early on in teaching these courses, I have made tweaks and alterations and additions and, I mean, adjustments every year, and for different, you know what I mean, demographics as well. Like I teach this class at the U.S. Naval Academy now in the spring, and that's a different group, as they're undergrads and they're midshipmen and they're off to be naval officers. So I altered the syllabus a little bit differently. And I also add things that I learn and other presentations that I see often from connections and be like, hey, this is a new idea or this is a new thing. Or sometimes I will change things because I find a better way to explain it by just through trial and error of iterations of teaching it. So, you know, I mean, it's always a constant evolution in terms of this syllabus.
Yeah. It occurred to me, I hadn't explicitly intended to do this, but Rex, you got any questions for either Sebastian or Jeff?
Well, I mean, it's a point that Jeff made earlier. It is challenging teaching game design remotely. But knowing that most of my students haven't done anything like this before, when I'm in the classroom, I rely heavily on looking for confused faces, know whether I need to speed up or slow down, and catching students to and from class and asking how things are going and them catching me. And, you know, that has been the challenge this year is taking what is normally an in-person course and teaching it remotely, particularly because there's a more uncertain knowledge and comfort level than there is in my other regular poli-sci courses. And, you know, I can't tell that via Zoom. Their cameras are usually off, and even if they weren't, I can't look at 44 cameras while I'm you know, running a Zoom seminar. So that has been the biggest challenge. And I hope that they're all bothering me as much as they should be. I'm a little worried that they're not, but we will see when the term ends. So that, you know, I'm interested how the other two are dealing with that challenge of teaching online.
Jeff, ideas, thoughts?
You know, it was a real change for me to move to a classroom environment from more of a business meeting environment. For example, I'm on the board at GAMA, which is the Game Manufacturers Association. We have monthly meetings on Zoom. That is usually somewhere between 12 and 16 people who are medium to senior people in their professions. Everybody's got a camera on. Everybody is engaged. Everybody's got an agenda. The expectations in a class, or I don't know if they're expectations. This is the reality in my class, is that no one ever has a camera on. Every once in a while, it will become clear that someone has just wandered away from their computer because they, you know, stop responding, or they are, you know, have fallen out of their group. Until I realized that Safari was not going to support Collaborate well enough. Like, my breakout rooms were a technical disaster because I couldn't move in between them. So it has just been like the social expectations in a class were dramatically different from what I experienced in a more professional environment.
Jeff, you got any questions for Sebastian or Rex? I mean, I know they're dealing with a different kind of game design than the sort of thing you're teaching.
So I don't know if this is a question or not. I mean, I guess it is specifically not a question, but one of the first things out of Sebastian's mouth that I loved was the idea that he wants to promote intellectual omnivores. And I think that is a great pair of words to put next to each other. And I think that's a magnificent philosophy to sort of, I don't know if push on people is the right way. That makes it sound like drugs or something, but I love that. So I wanted to bring that back up and highlight that as a great philosophy.
If you're going to get them hooked on something, it might as well be that.
That's right.
Yeah. So when I tell my students to be intellectual omnivores, I tell them, as game designers, you're not restricted the same way you are as, like, you're writing an academic paper, right? So I encourage them to do primary sources and look at academic papers and books, but you're not only limited to that as a game designer. You can look at other ways to tell the story of your game or your case study. For instance, I tell them to go watch film, go read letters from people, so bringing up Sawyer's game again, on the Three Kingdoms, one of the things that they went to read and as a research item was to read a Chinese graphic novel about the Three Kingdoms. And they told me that it was a great way for them to understand the narrative of the story, right, of the history. And it was a really influential element to their game design. So in that way, I tell them to go hunt down information in all its forms, whether it be YouTube videos, graphic novels, film, other people's designs or rule sets, like consume everything. And the hard part as designers, I think, is to learn when to apply judiciously and selectively what you need in what time. I think that just sort of comes with experience.
I'm not going to name names because I don't want to embarrass anybody out there, and it's not somebody on this call, but I remember having a conversation at Origins 15-ish years ago with a war game designer, and doing what you had talked about, Sebastian, like going and reading lots of different sources and material that trying to get the best grasp of the scope of what it was he was working on. And I was asking, I said, so what ended up being like the key thing that you really found the inspiration in? He said, I will never admit this out loud outside of this conversation. It was Soldier of Fortune magazine. And I looked at him and said, really? He said, the way the article was written for the dude being there in, you know, as it was happening, that was the feeling that I wanted to evoke for the players in the game. Whether it was real or accurate, or, you know, it was obviously horribly slanted toward the sort of gonzo adventurism of the magazine, but that was the feeling he wanted the players to experience in the game. And he said that was the article that really sort of made it all click. That was what I was after. And so you talk about where you find weird inspiration. Yeah.
That's great. I love that.
Yeah, it was that. That's what he was after. So that's kind of where he ended up. Guys, thank you very much for you know, indulging me on this podcast, for picking your brains on some things here. I hope the audience has found this useful and interesting, and you know, a wide range of perspectives here in some of the different games, and game design philosophies, and the tools you're trying to put in your students' toolboxes. So I really appreciate y'all taking the time on this. I do have a little bit of business we got to tackle here as a part of our podcast. So we've got our Patreon, Armchair, you know, patreon.com/armchairdragoons. You can find it linked at our website. But one of the things that we've got is that patrons of a certain level get mentioned by name and thanked for their support here on the podcast. And this time we're actually up to 4 patrons at that level. And so, Joseph Knoll, welcome to the podcast as a supporter of the Armchair Dragoons. We really appreciate your support of the regiment. And then, as always, Treb Curry and Kevin Bertram and Patrick Garrity, thank you very much for your support of the Dragoons. We really appreciate you guys helping keep us, you know, the technology costs that we've got, and helping keep us on the air and on the web. And so thank you very much for supporting us there. And so for folks looking for, you know, the support on the Patreon, that's where you find us. We've got it linked at the top of our site, and you can find it there. Real quick, so Sebastian, we've got our next ACDC, the next Armchair Dragoons Digital Conventions, coming up in the middle of June. You're going to have a couple of students ready to show off their work for us, right?
We'll see. Hopefully I'll have some in who are able to do it. This is one of the great difficulties. Unlike my Georgetown students, where I have a little bit more power over them, the midshipmen's lives are a little more regimented, and a lot of my first years or my seniors who are graduating, they're going off to the fleet, and I had lose all control over them.
Yeah.
But hopefully some of my younger groups will be able to present on some of their games, or at least will be able to present on what we're doing at the U.S. Naval Academy in terms of educational gaming.
We can bring back some Goose students or some previous war game design class folks. That'd be totally cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We'll find somebody for you.
Awesome. Rex, somehow we got to figure out a way to get one of your mega games into the digital.
Yeah, so the thing, I don't like mega games online. I'm doing tons of digital gaming, but you know, for me, mega games are 100 people running around in semi-chaos, just not the same with Electrons.
Oh, absolutely. No. I totally get that. I'm not disputing that it wouldn't be better in person, but I have had people ask about, hey, are you guys going to do any of the bigger events that you, because that's what we do sometimes at Origins. We've got those bigger. Heck, Jeff was in the booth right next to us watching us do these at Origins a couple of years ago, that we normally have these bigger, crazier kinds of things going on. So I've had people ask. And so I'm like, well, I'm going to be talking to Rex here in a, you know, couple of weeks. I'll ask. So digital mega game, not going to happen.
Not lots of people are doing them, but I'm not one of them. So,
fine. All right. Jeff is may not be in a position to say, is Origins actually going to happen in October?
I think that is 95% likely.
All right. Well, I'm hoping we're going to be able to wrangle up enough Dragoons to actually be there this year. We've still got some folks that have, you know, some of the expected health concerns and such. We have totally stolen the original weekend of Origins in June for our next digital convention this summer, under the premise that everybody was expecting to be playing war games with us that weekend anyway. Now they just have to do it from their desk at home instead of meeting with us in Columbus. So we've appropriated the original weekend of Origins to do that. I hope you guys don't mind.
Oh, that's great. And they have no excuse. So
yeah, well, I'm sure somebody will find one, but we will ignore them and make fun of them. Gentlemen, thank you very much for the time this evening. I really appreciate it. We've run a little long, and you know, by the time I edit this down, we will still have run a little. But I do appreciate you guys being able to take the time and join us here. And so, thank you very much. And audience, thank you for, you know, hanging out with us here on another podcast on Mentioned in Dispatches. And we'll talk to you again down the line.